evening and welcome to the October 3rd meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. You see we have several people here and thank you for coming. The board met in closed session and we discussed the superintendent's goals for the year 2006-2007. No action was taken. So let's move forward on the consensus on the order of business. Is everybody okay with the order of business? Okay, very good. All right, let's then go on to approval of minutes. Do I hear a motion and then we can have some discussion?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Been moved by Mr. Spadafore. Seconded by Mr. Millar. Discussion. Mrs. Dickinson. Yeah, it got a little loud.
I just had one quick correction on page 3. It talked about consensus. It says board members offer differing views about how to proceed with consensus that the district should entitle the property to its most valuable use. And I just remember Chris saying, I actually checked out the video, and saying that 5 of 6 board members felt this way and 1 didn't. So I would like to just insert the little phrase, with consensus among 5 of 6 board members, that the district should entitle the property. And that's my main thing I want to add. I kind of would like to add, since it says Mrs. Dickinson dissented in favor of a public-private partnership concept, I mean, I don't have to put this in, but I dissented in favor of leaving the property as is for now or pursuing public-private partnership concept. So we can either make both of those changes or just the first one, whatever the board wants to, or neither. It's up to you guys. But
that second piece was my recollection, that you supported leaving the property as...
Everyone agrees. I thought that was consensus instead.
The majority reached consensus.
Then I certainly accede to Adrian's suggestion changes.
Could actually, following what Mrs. Botwin is saying, perhaps with the majority reaching consensus or something like that, that wordsmiths a little better. And then I would support this part about leaving the property as it is for now, because that was something that you were pretty clear about.
I was. Okay, thanks.
So my motion can be modified to include those changes you just discussed.
Okay, Mrs. Holmes, do you have that? Okay, so we have a motion and an amendment, actually, and all in favor of the motion as amended?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. I have to abstain from
sorry.
That.
Okay.
At the time you guys were doing that, I'm very sorry. I was in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Carries.
So I just thought I should let you know I wasn't here at that time.
Carries 6-0. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
With Mrs. Botwin abstaining. All right. The board did not receive any correspondence, so we can move on to public comment. But I would ask that if you have a cell phone, that you put it on vibrate or turn it off, please. Thank you. Or change the tune. Fight on for more obey. That's the tune we want to hear. Public comment. And we have one person for public comment, and that's Mr. Buckman.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. My name is Mark Buckman. I live in San Luis Obispo. I am here tonight representing Ag in the Classroom. I am on the Ag in the Classroom Committee. Ag in the Classroom on October 12th is a Thursday. For the fourth year, we'll host thousands of fourth graders up at the Mid-State Fairgrounds, where they get a hands-on look at agriculture, which is the largest part of our economy in San Luis Obispo County. And I would like to invite all of you to come up and attend this. It's amazing. There are ranchers, vintners, farmers, all types of activities, and it ties directly to the fourth grade curriculum. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buckman. And what time is that, please?
Thank you for the extra time, Mr. President. It starts at 8:45 in the morning and goes through lunch.
Great. Thank you.
And I think we could find an extra hamburger.
Okay, thanks. October 12th at the Mid-State Fairgrounds, but I think it's not called the Mid-State Fairgrounds anymore. I think they've changed the name of it to something like the Central
Blue Ribbon School.
Our principal, Mr. Zodovich, and an educator, Mr. Schofield, will be flying back to Washington, D.C. on November 9th through 10th, and we are proud to see our accomplishments recognized through an award that colleges and employers will hopefully take into consideration when looking for prospective students and employees. On a sadder note, we said goodbye to our assistant principal, Mr. Pruitt, last week. Mr. Zodovich had a well-attended going-away party where the stories and sometimes tears flowed. We just received our first email from Mr. Pruitt today, and he has arrived safely and is settling into his new job that started yesterday. We are beginning to receive applications for the new vacant spot of assistant principal. Our ASB is working overtime to get ready for our homecoming next week, beginning with a band performance on Monday, movie night on Tuesday, a carnival on Wednesday, a bonfire on Thursday, and the game on Friday, and the dance on Saturday. You are all invited to join in the festivities the ASB is working on so hard to put together. Please come. Our golf fundraiser is taking place Saturday at the Avila Beach Golf Course, with breakfast being served at 8 a.m. and the golf beginning at 9. We are proud to have many people involved in Morro Bay High School volunteering at the Morro Bay Harbor Fest, and our cheerleaders will also be there with music boosters later this month. Morro Bay High School is having their PSAT this the weekend of October 21st from 8 to 12. Last year's PSAT results put three of our students at the level of National Merit Commended Scholar, but sadly there were no semifinalists or finalists. These three commended scholars are Christina Miller, Addison Cugini, and Yonatan Moskowitz, which is me. Thank you. This year is speeding by, and the end of the first quarter is October 27th. That's also the same day that the choir is traveling to Westmont College to attend a choral event. The Oktoberfest in Los Osos is being held on October 29th with a cross-country team hosting the Oktoberfest 5-kilometer run again, which you are all invited to run in if you so choose. I'm sure the team will gladly train you if you need the motivation. Lastly, our football team is 1-0 in the league with a win over Santa Maria Saints last week, 49-12. We play Templeton this Friday, and once again, you're all invited to attend. I'd like to thank Mrs. Dickinson for the lovely cookies tonight, and that's all from Morro Bay High School.
Thank you. And next, I can't read your name. I'm sorry.
I'm Nicole Watson, and I'm representing Pacific Beach High School. And I'd like to start off by saying we have a new math teacher, the trial competition casebooks. And that case involves a bomb near a trash can near a cafeteria at a school. And our fingers are crossed for the TEACH grants. Ms. Jacobson applied for guest artists. Ms. Newman applied for mock trial. And Kirk wants to take students to a PCPA performance. And that's it.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm the representative of San Luis Obispo High School, and just to start off, we had a memorial this last Tuesday, September 26th, for our loved Mr. O'Reilly, who was our campus supervisor and athletic department assistant. The memorial went really well. The students and staff all put it on as like an assembly, and everyone responded, I think, very well to it. And it was a sad loss, but there was a lot of respect at the memorial, and I was really proud of our school for that. On a lighter note, tomorrow in the cafeteria is our UC application night at 7 o'clock, meeting with the counselors and the students. Next week, the 11th, we have the CSU application night, also at 7 in the cafeteria. The 13th, at 6 o'clock, we have coffee night with our drama club in the theater. Everyone's excited about that. The 14th, we have the SAT 1 and 2s at Cuesta. The 14th, the SLO High School will be hosting the FFA Leadership Conference. And the 17th, we have 9th and 10th grade college planning night, 7 p.m. at the cafeteria. And then we're really excited about the week of the 23rd, which is homecoming. We have an assembly at that Monday at 11:15. Our theme this year is Cities of Rhythm, and we're really excited about it. So we just picked four cities, and we're going to have it kind of music-based. We did our voting last week for our homecoming nominees, and we have lots of fun activities like Powder Puff Football the 25th at 4:30, freshmen versus sophomores and juniors versus seniors, and I'm hoping seniors will win. And then we have the dance on Saturday, the 28th, in the new gym. That's always really fun dance of the year. We have fun spirit days like color day, poser day, where I'll be in 10 years and things like that. The parade is the 27th on Friday at 3:15, and everyone's invited to watch that. It's kind of fun. And the game is the 27th, and we're...
We have reports from school staff and student... we just did the student representatives to the board. We have a couple of people who are here to talk to us about their schools. First, Mr. Zotovich from Morro Bay High School.
Mr. President, could I intercede for just a moment?
Sure.
It is an off. Yoni has already informed us of the good news that we had heard a week or so ago. But it isn't often enough that someone gets to introduce the principal of a national blue ribbon high school, a distinction which places Morro Bay High School in this case among the premier high schools in America, and one of two outstanding high schools that we have in San Luis Coastal as well. So it's my pleasure to announce at this time the principal of a national blue ribbon high school, Mr. Pete Zotovich.
Thank you very much. Pete Zotovich, the principal at Morro Bay High School. We are very, very proud of this honor, and still think we need to pinch ourselves every once in a while. While the newspaper made a comment that it's high test scores, I think it's anything but high test scores. I think it's teamwork, focus, working together, and I think this board and our central admin have a place with that. You give us some of the resources and the tools we need to make it work at our school. I think that our staff takes those tools and resources, and they think about the students, and they look at each and every individual student, and they try to make some positive effort each year for student achievement so they can be better. We are so lucky we are a unified school district, because not only does Morro Bay High School on the coast excel in its academics, but I believe the one middle school and the three elementaries that feed us absolutely do a fabulous job before the students get to us. So it's a real team effort amongst everybody we have in our district. And it's really something that we're able to garnish this wonderful award. And so we're really excited. And our staff has been very, very focused through the years, the last few years. And they have deserve everything they've received. Our teachers are fabulous. Our classified staff's just wonderful, and our students outstanding. They take it serious, but the coast is what feeds us into our high school, and they just do a fabulous job. So one little side note, I just want the board to know that this year when we had our staff meeting, we have 241 freshmen last year that took the English part of the test, and that's 100% of our kids took the CST test for English. And that's all of our special ed, that's all of our EL, all of our socioeconomic disadvantage, all of our students that are low in reading, everybody took the test. We have no kids that are far below basic when the results came back. Every student at the school is either below, we don't have one student that's far below basic. And we have most of our kids that are proficient in advance. So that is teamwork from a group of people that are working independently to work with our individual students, but then they're also working very hard as a team to move them forward. And it may not happen again, but boy, it happened this last year, and I just wanted you to know as a board what a fabulous job all the people that did with our ninth grade students this last year as far as helping them achieve that kind of a goal. So thank you again. We really appreciate the recognition.
Thank you, Mr. Zotovich.
At this time, I'd like to introduce Linda Todd, who is going to introduce one of our students that is a national FFA finalist, and there's only four in the nation that are not national FFA finalists. So I appreciate the FFA in the fourth grade as they move through, and it's a great program, and I'd like to introduce Linda Todd and Ryan Duclos.
Good evening. We were here before you last spring when we talked about student achievements, and there's one achievement that I didn't know about at the time. We were hopeful on Ryan. Last year in the 2005-2006 school year, there were about 496,000 FFA members nationwide, and about a half of 1% of those FFA members receive the American degree every year. They have a lot of qualifications that they have to meet before they can receive the highest degree that's awarded by the FFA. And we also have one student that is receiving the American degree this year. Her name is Taryn Green, and she will be going back with us to Indianapolis the end of this month to receive her American degree. Mr. Ryan Duclos, with me this evening, has already met all qualifications to receive the American degree except one, and that is that they can't...
National proficiency finalist. There's 51 proficiencies in the FFA, all the way from ag mechanics to swine production. The proficiency that I am a national finalist for is small animal production and care placement. My work is I volunteered at the local San Luis Obispo County Animal Services for 6 years. I've worked at numerous veterinary clinics, and I've worked at a dog grooming and boarding facility. I have nearly 2,000 hours both volunteered and paid, and nearly $7,500 earned or invested. I'm really excited. I leave for Indianapolis on October 24th, and hopefully we'll be representing San Luis Coastal Unified School District as well as the state of California, and I'll hopefully come home with the number one. Thank you.
And I just, on behalf of the board, Ryan, we just want to wish you the very best and good luck. It's going to be a great experience, and we're really proud of you and Mrs. Todd and just all the FFA members of both San Luis Obispo and Morbay High Schools. You guys do a great job, so thanks.
Thank you very much.
Any other? Okay, Jackie Kirk Martinez.
Good evening. Thank you. I'd like to take a moment right now to introduce to you, later on in the agenda is the appointment for CAC representative for special education, SELPA. And I'd like to take this opportunity right now, before the night wears on and families need to get home to their children. Last year, I brought to you Mrs. Lisa Simon, and she'll be here probably later on this evening. And the CAC representatives, there's two from our district. They represent the special needs students in our district. And the San Luis Obispo Special Education Local Plan area works as a collaborative of all districts. The CAC gets together monthly and works collaboratively on what they designed last year was a cookbook that will be for sale rather soon. It's just been produced, and they help to support the special needs students in our district. Lisa Simons replaced Jaime Riley Akers, who was part of the CAC as a parent for many years and is now a community member at large. We would like to. Michelle and her husband live in Los Osos with their 6-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter. She formerly has been employed by Atascadero State Hospital as a recreation therapist and would like to help support the special needs students in our district and help provide education to our parents in our community. So I bring to you Michelle and hopefully Lisa real soon.
Welcome.
Do you have any questions?
Mrs. Botwin.
I believe that's item 16 on our agenda, and you're right, it probably
that's
will be
correct.
A bit later. And I did have circled here both Lisa and Michelle. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for filling in and taking this seat and continuing to work for our kids, especially our special need kids. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Anybody else from the school that would like to speak to the board? Okay. Mr. Miller, status of the state budget.
You know, at this time, I don't really have much of import. And considering the time, I think I'll pass until the next meeting. Thank you.
Okay. Let's move on to item number 3, a resolution number 040607, support of Proposition 1D, Kindergarten University Public Education Facilities Bond Act of 2006. Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Every so often, the state legislature passes a bill which puts in front of the voters a proposition for the funding of school facilities from a K through 14 viewpoint. This is such a proposition, and I think it's important that the board consider the position of supporting this in the state of California. It isn't necessarily a local issue, but it is an educational issue. There are numerous school districts up and down the state which require millions of dollars of funding in order to build high schools and modernize old facilities for educating kids, and this proposition is designed to do just that. It's a $10 billion plus dollar proposition, and it needs the support of everybody who believes in education.
Yes, Mrs. Botwin.
Yeah, nice to get anything that we can, Russell, but would you tell us, you're saying if Proposition is 1D is approved by...
Which as it is, the state of California and the health of education for everybody.
Okay, so we won't get any extra money for additional classrooms, anything, we won't get any of that?
No, the problem is that we don't need any, and that's why we wouldn't get any.
Okay.
We're not eligible.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Mr. Millar.
I just was curious, are there safeguards to prevent interpretations that this money will somehow supplant Prop 98 guaranteed levels or other kinds of entitled funding?
Excellent question, and the answer is yes. This has nothing to do with Prop 98. It's totally outside of Prop 98, and there's language that that specifies that within the bill.
And I believe that this bill is supported by the California School Board Association and ACSA. And Mr. Buckman, I don't know, maybe you can help us out. Is this bill supported by PTA, or do they take those kinds of...
Okay. It is, as you say, supported by all of the alphabet soup organizations for education. In addition to that, it has a component that Dr. Valentine just reminded me about for industrial arts and provides for facilities in that aspect, one of which is a goal and interest of the board. So when I answered Ms. Bywin's question, that is one piece that is yet to be delineated specifically, but there is money in there for the industrial arts program that we would be eligible for.
Move resolution 040607.
It's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mrs. Dickinson. Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Millar.
Aye.
Mrs. Dickinson.
Aye.
Mrs. Botwin.
Yes.
Mrs. Roger.
Yes.
Mr. Unger.
Yes.
Mr. Spadafore. Mr. Peter.
Let's then move on to item number 4, which is another resolution. This is resolution number 050607, determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. Damien.
Good evening, Damien Barnett, Director of Instructional Services. This resolution just outlines the plan to participate in the current adoption cycle for history, social science, and science. And a public hearing was held on this item on September 19th, and the item is now presented for action.
Okay. Mrs. Dickinson, and then Mr.
I just had a question that occurred to me this week. Does one textbook per student mean a book that you can take home, that you check out, or does it mean that you have access to a text in your classroom and you might have a class set?
I've been concerned and brought this up last year and the year before about having extra books supplied for classroom sets and that the students be able to take a book home that remains with them for the semester, quarter, or the year. For this reason, we have discussed this briefly but never done anything about it, the backpack hump that I see growing among our students from carrying these large bags of books, and knowing that some of the English books and history books weigh anywhere from 5 to 8 to 9 pounds. At this point, I'm asking for information. Oh, thank you. I'm seeing some nodding heads. That's a nice feeling. I want information about how much would it cost us to have extra sets then that would be classroom sets. And then use the old textbooks as time goes on. We use the old textbooks, covers missing, kids don't care. They stick in the backpack, take it home, and sits there for the year, and they have reference to it. But how much would it, to initiate a program like this, how much would it cost us by supplying? Thank you. And that's, may I join up with the other item? You're here later in the book. It talks about the it talks about the textbooks, and we have, for example, in, thank you, I don't, I'm not, the, like, for example, the 9th and 10th grade English students will be using the same textbook. And over a period of a year or two, as the bad ones are pulled out, the ones that are semi-destroyed or broken up, pages missing, et cetera, it would alleviate the burden of our purchasing sufficient qualities for the classroom set, which would alleviate any major expense for this. I don't know if you guys have looked at your little kids. I'm at a corner, and the Senshammer kids go right by my corner from that area to school, and I see these little tiny kindergarten kids, and they're going by carrying this book bag, and they're hunched over already, and this is for kindergarten. And I see the kids that are coming home that are in fifth and sixth grade, and they are hunched over. Now, this is something we need to take care of, and I thought we could start gently, fiscally wise, and move with it. Thank you.
Okay. Yoni, I'm sorry.
That's fine. Let me just comment from what I've seen from students and from my own experience.
All I'm good. Measured for his senior prom suit, you know, one shoulder is permanently lower than the other from his backpack, and it does affect their bodies.
Mr. President,
yeah,
I'm not sure what this has to do with item four.
Thank you. I was going to get there, Walter. Thank you very much. Well, we need to get back.
506-07.
Okay, we have a motion by Mrs. Botwin and a second by Mrs. Dickinson for item 050607. Is there any other discussion on this item? Okay.
Can I just ask one clarifying question?
Yes, please.
Mrs. Botwin, I just want to make sure I'm going to come back with some information from you on what it would cost to have an extra a class set along with a book to take home, but I didn't get the piece about the English books at 9th and 10th grade. Or
I was just going a step further that by the time they get to that level, we'll have extra books, and there won't be in a cost anymore because the English books, history books, and so on, we usually tend to use for 5 to 10 years. So, you know, it'll pay for itself. Thank you. Just, yeah.
Okay. Mrs. Holmes.
Mrs. Botwin. Yes. Mrs. Dickinson. Yes. Mr. Peter. Yes. Mr. Spadafore. Yes. Mr. Unger. Yes. Mrs. Roger. Yes. Mr. Millar.
Let's move on to item number 5, the proposed new board policy 5131.63, steroids, and this is second reading, Mr. Robinette.
Yes, thank you. First of all, I apologize. I have a correction on the actual agenda title. It says personnel/steroids. It's really a student policy. It should read student steroids as the proposed board policy does, so I apologize for not having that corrected. Yes, this is a student policy. This represents a second reading of a proposed board policy expressing the serious health hazards and prohibition toward steroid and performance-enhancing drug use. The wording of the policy, and I'm referring to the blue page, is mostly from the California School Board Association and is consistent with Ed Code 49030 CIF bylaws and our practice for some time in our athletic program. The issue that arose at the last board meeting was around the paragraph describing the consequences or the potential consequences applied to a student in violation of the policy. The suggested language reflects our current athletic contracts, and it reads, and it's the underlined first section underlined, that reads, a student who is found to have violated the agreement of this policy consider and obviously you can play with this language also, and that reads, a student who is found to have violated the agreement or this policy shall be subject to disciplinary procedures, including, but not limited to, restriction from the interscholastic sport in which the violation occurred for a period up to the duration of the season, or I suppose you can say for life, or whatever we wanted to be the most extreme, and suspension or expulsion in accordance with law, board policy, and administrative regulation. So that is also there for your consideration. I included a third option, which perhaps is in better keeping with other student policies within our board policy, and that is not to determine in policy the actual consequences for a violation, but leave that to administrative regulations in our conduct code, taking into account that we would listen to your recommendations, obviously, in writing those administrative regulations. So you may also choose to not define the consequences in policy, but make the policy statement affirming your prohibition of steroid use. Our aim in the athletic program is to train coaches and to train students in the health dangers inherent in performing and performance-enhancing supplements, and we are here to take direction and also answer questions. We do have, I think we have one of our athletic directors, Vic Eklund, who is here, both of our high school principals, and I'm also here to answer any questions you might have.
Who would like to begin? Okay, Mr. Millar, and then we'll go on down the table.
Rick, I have a couple of preliminary questions. There's a reference in the policy to the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Do they have penalties established?
No, my understanding is the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency is an organization that informs CIF. These are the supplements that are currently banned. It's a you know, clearinghouse of what supplements are banned for use to the CIF.
I think what initially disturbed me about this issue the most, and Chris kind of alluded to it last time, is we attended a CSBA presentation on this, and what was startling for me was mostly in the area of supplements, not steroids specifically, was the students were sometimes influenced to use them by other athletes and sometimes even other staff members. So I do appreciate the fact that we have a progressive student discipline policy that we see our kids, for whatever reason, who are involved in drugs and somehow comes into conflict in school or in sports activities, and and that's how they come to us. To me, that's a different proposition. I favor, as I discussed last time, more than a 30-day suspension, but I have been thinking a lot about it. I think I favor the stated kind of maximum penalty with the option for the board to adjust within that suspension for a season, but then the board can make whatever decisions it needs to make and make whatever adjustments in the penalty. But I do like stating a maximum penalty rather than having a fixed, what I consider relatively minor penalty, 30 days for this. And I do think we need to elevate it to the message to be to the students that this is something different than and this can affect your whole life. This is fundamental to the ethics of sport and competition. And I also think we need to look at including in our student-athlete contract for the parents and students the requirement that they will participate in a drug test if they are requested to do so by the district. And if they refuse, it should be somewhat like the implied consent driving law. If you refuse to take the test, then you don't get to participate in driving for a set period of time or whatever. I just think this is a distinct message that we need to make sure that we communicate to our students loudly and clearly.
I agree with everything Wallace said. I read the board book, even though I missed the last meeting, and I saw as much as I could on TV. You guys, that meeting was so short. I didn't get to see very much. Yeah. A couple of things. First of all, I noticed that Sally Connell is here tonight, and I would like to direct to her both a compliment for the excellent article that you had in the Trib and a criticism that I got a lot of phone calls from people and that had some pretty strong feelings about this concerning the use of steroids in sports. And a number of them said the onus then from this is either a parent lets the school know of a violation or a school personnel or the coach or so on. And I'd like to know that what can we do and what is their random testing that might have more teeth in this kind of procedure?
Templeton Unified School District, it's been about 8 years now, has taken on random drug and alcohol testing in their policy as a administrative reg attached to their board policy about random drug testing. So they test 10% of their athletes on a random basis for drug and alcohol. Their specific board policy says there will be no disciplinary consequences. However, a first finding will result in a 30-day suspension from the sport, and students must undertake mandatory drug counseling, follow-up tests, what have you. But it's random to 10% of the students. Last year, they added steroids to that policy, and they randomly test 1%, or the policy actually reads at least 1% of their students for steroid use. It's a far more expensive test than the follow-up test because they require two tests. There has to be a positive, and to make sure it's not a false positive, a follow-up test. They've been doing that policy for about 8 years. They've added the steroid piece this last year. It's very expensive, but it's something they're the only district I'm aware of in our area that's undertaken random drug testing.
And how many have they found when they've done the random steroid testing?
I don't believe they've caught any steroid use yet. With random drug testing, they have
yeah, I was just thinking of the
not
the,
with steroids yet.
Yeah,
it's a fairly new thing for them also.
I would like to see us incorporate some kind of random steroid testing, in the sense that they do it to 1%. Is that right?
Their administrative regulations read that at least 1% of the students will be tested.
Okay, that's not a whole lot of bodies if they random test, but I'm just thinking that the teeth, as small as they are, with the random drug testing, could possibly prevent some of our kids from using the steroids, perhaps more than they're using them now, or at all. And as our policy is, it's a good policy, but it's sort of a Lake Wobegon policy. You know, our women are all strong, our men are all handsome, and our kids are all above average. And not using steroids, yeah. So what do the rest of you guys think?
In looking at the policy, it states, as it's beefed up, a student who is found to have violated the agreement of this policy shall be subject to disciplinary procedures, including but not limited to restriction from the interscholastic sport in which the violation occurred for a period up to the duration of the season, and suspension or expulsion in accordance with law, board policy, and administrative regulation. And I note in the other example that has been provided to us, expulsion is also included. Since I've been on the board, we typically allow a first drug offense, and we see a student for expulsion on a second. So are we saying that with regard to the athletic students, they could potentially come up for expulsion on a first offense?
Not according to the way our current conduct code and athletic contract reads. So our current conduct code for any drug offense would not result in expulsion on a first offense, unless it was selling, I believe.
That's the only correction I would add. There are drug offenses that result in one-time offenses that result in expulsion, but they usually involve sale or distribution.
Thank you. I'd like to speak to this again maybe later.
So a question I would have, although I know we'll be taking a vote on this. Are you thinking about blanket drug testing or of steroid testing specifically is kind of what I'm asking.
Personally speaking, I don't know that I'm ready to make any kind of a determination about drug testing of any kind tonight.
Okay. And I'm a proponent of this policy. In my opinion, taking steroids is cheating, and it's pretty simple, and it's cheating your fellow athletes and cheating your team and cheating yourself because it's hurting your body. My concern is the due process issue, and if we're going to be accusing kids of taking supplements or steroids, what do we do to assure their due process so that if we're getting to a point where we're saying that we want to
But the problem has risen, or we have a problem that demands that. I was more interested in including in the contract the requirement that a student athlete participate in a drug test. And so as far as the due process concern is, if you are, and I don't mean to set it aside casually because it's always present when a public agency is taking action, but when it comes to a contract matter, it's good faith and fair dealing. So basically, we would be obligated to not request a student athlete to participate in a drug test unless we were acting in good faith and had some reason, some basis to make that request. And to me, until we have demonstrated to us we have a larger problem than what I think might be going on currently, I think what we do is we count on staff to look for signs of unusual signs that may be an indicator of steroid use, and then based upon the athlete's contract, request that they take a test to see if that is the case.
Okay, and so what I heard you propose earlier is if the athlete refuses based on the contract they have to take the test, that's grounds for an automatic suspension or whatever of their participation in it. If we're insisting that the student undergo the test and then the student is found to fail both of them, are you suggesting that this is the board policy that would come into play on that?
Well, then what is better for me is the language stating the maximum with the option of the board to reduce or make whatever determination it wants up to that suspension for a season.
Okay. So, again, my issue is due process and making sure that it's fair. And well, a suspension, and that's true, a suspension in athletics wouldn't, as Mrs. Roger points out, wouldn't typically come to the board.
Yeah,
we're talking, sort of board policy versus administrative.
Well, I want to make sure we get everyone is expressing, but I would have a couple clarifying questions. I mean, the board is typically not involved in any disciplinary procedure except for expulsion. If you wanted us, I think we'd have to really consider some different processes if the board was going to be involved in either hearing.
Thanks, Chris. Something that would help me is to make sure that we separate the discussion regarding a steroid policy from the discussion regarding alcohol and illegal drugs, because the two aren't the same and they don't have the same effect and you don't have the same preparation in terms of their use. The athletes already sign a code which indicates they will not use alcohol and drugs while they're participating in team sports. And there's also a number of cases that have affected high schools who have attempted to initiate testing for alcohol and drugs, where they said it could only be for programs that are not part of the daily curriculum, that are only extracurricular. So that's an honor, not a required participation by the student. So that's why the athletes come under that purview. If we're talking about the steroid discussion tonight, it may be helpful, to focus on that just so we can clear this issue up, and then other issues regarding the code of conduct and how that would apply to students may be a broader discussion that needs to be discussed with others who are in the field the athletic department, because certainly drugs and alcohol affect a person in the classroom as much, if not more, than somebody who's participating in athletic events. So you've got a mixed message there in terms of what's more important. You participating for the school in athletics or going to class and being able to focus and be a student in that setting. The thing about steroids is that it takes many months to begin a program and many months to stop that program, to get it out of your system. You have to think of the possibility of having some kind of a voluntary initiation by students who participate in athletes, where you give them a period, 3 months, 6 months, to give them a day where they can start so they can take care of a problem if it exists. Because if there is a penalty at some point, it's probably helpful for them to be aware of it and to address it on their own before they get to the point where they may face some kind of punishment. And it may take several months for that to be fixed by a student who is taking steroids. I agree with everybody that steroids is the wrong thing. Professional athletes give that message to students that it's performance that matters, irrespective of the health problems it creates and the inequity on the playing field. But I think if we're an educational institution, we want to set it up in a way that the students understand the responsibility they have, but given the opportunity to address any issues that they may bring to a new policy, which would be that period to go ahead and address that issue. The second thing coaches can see over the course of a period of time in terms of personality changes, bodily changes, which could indicate there's a need to have that physical revisited with the physician who first cleared the student of any health problems, including the health problem of having something in their body that's not prescribed and could cause permanent damage down the road. So that's another approach. And then the last comment I have is on the first page, which I think, Rick, you prepared as kind of an overview.
Yes.
It talked about coaches or staff in the fourth paragraph, the last sentence, or the second sentence. And I know this doesn't deal with staff, but you put at that point, any coach who distributes, sells, promotes, and goes on is going to face some type of penalty for it. And I think that's important to remember because a lot of adults do support or encourage. But I think we should add something to the effect that after promotes or fails to intervene and prevent the use of, because I think there has to be a proactive role of any coach in any school district who believes there's a problem to step in and say, look, we have a period where you can voluntarily correct this problem. Let's begin doing it and come under that period where someone can change a course of action, and then it can go on and say that. So I think this is a bigger issue, and it doesn't include alcohol and drugs tonight, but I think in terms of a medical approach and in terms of a policing approach, we can do something more comprehensive.
I think it's important to remember, too, that we have a new policy about training coaches and that the education piece is going to be in place in a stronger way. And that's a really important part of this, of teaching the kids about it. And they may think liver failure will never happen to them, but I can see them being a little worried about acne or impotence, hopefully, in the future. You know, if they know about these things, it helps their picture. There's so much pressure on kids to achieve now. I think it's unfortunate in our society. Everyone needs a 4.6 now to get in college, and you need to be, you know, so great in their athletic prowess. And Laverne College had a coach, Coach Ortmeyer, and I think he was even written up in Sports Illustrated. This is several years ago. He said a perfect season was winning half your games and losing half your games. And he really stressed the academic achievement and from participating in athletics for a minimum of 30 days and shall be subject to disciplinary procedures, including but not limited to suspension or expulsion in accordance with the law, et cetera. In the first or, it becomes a new minimum, which is pretty extreme. It's not like starting with the maximum and going down. It's creating a new, really severe minimum, is how it reads. In the third or, it talks about allowing the athletic contract and conduct code or administrative regulation to define the consequences. So looking at the athletic contract, though, we might want to actually suggest that maybe they, well, the first, the A in athletic, grounds for suspension or dismissal from a team, athletes who possess, use, sell, or otherwise furnish, or are found to be under the influence of alcoholic beverages, drugs, or anabolic steroids will result in a minimum 30-day calendar day suspension from all athletic team participation. We might want to put the same language, or they might want to in the athletic department, right there where there's, you know, stronger wording, the same wording from this, where it starts with 30-day but goes on to expulsion in the athletic contract, too. That would be more of a parallel. And it does allow for pretty extreme measures, and I think it speaks to the due process and letting the individual cases be appropriately dealt with.
I spoke out at the last meeting for a fairly strong policy here, and I still feel that way. I support the stronger language. And the reason is that taking steroids or cheating, and cheating to gain competitive advantage is wrong, and I think that we need to begin to break that cycle at a young age. We have an opportunity to do so by educating our kids about the dangers of steroids and their improper use. And I think the younger we can start that process, the better. You know, it's sort of a pandemic problem. I follow professional bicycling pretty closely, but we've all heard about the drug use in the Tour de France and the athletes there. But it's not just in, you know, it's not just in that sport. We've read about it in baseball. We've read about it in track and field. And I think we need to deliver a clear, strong message to the kids that this is wrong and that there's a stiff penalty if they do it. And I would even go further than what's written here and say that, would be prohibited from participating in the sport for the...
I just have a clarifying question. Is the board expecting students to turn in their team members? Because that is... They do spend most of the time with their peers in the locker room and hanging out. And so that could be a valuable scouting resource, but from what I've heard discussed, there is no real incentive for team members to turn in their peers because... It creates a feeling of unteamsmanship. That's not a word, but so among the team. Yeah, because you ratted on your. Exactly. And I actually have. I've witnessed where a peer had ideas about another peer doing steroids, but it was not ever reported. So that's firsthand experience. It does happen, and it's not reported by the peers.
I think one of the solutions to part of the issues that we've been talking about is to treat steroid use differently, and it's obvious in that letter A on the athletic contract. It's just awkward. It doesn't belong in there with alcoholic beverages and drugs under the influence. I mean, what is under the influence of anabolic steroids? I don't even know that it's psychoactive when you're taking it. I might be. I'm not an expert on any of that. So there's that distinction. But I think we can speak with a voice that says you're not going to do this, and if you do, there's going to be severe consequences. But reserve and make it an expulsion offense so that it does come to the board. I'm hoping that we wouldn't be getting a flood of expulsion hearings based on this. But bring it to the board, and then we can make these kinds of determinations about the cooperation of student. I don't think it should be delinked from expulsion, from the potential disciplinary side of the case. I don't, and I think it's a serious enough issue that it shouldn't be treated initially at the site level. Should not. I think it should come directly to the board for an expulsion hearing. I don't favor mandatory expulsion kinds of rules normally because they're kind of can be gotcha, and you know there's too many variables for each student, and it's taking for granted being there. The coaches, the assistant coaches, the volunteers get trained on what things to look for and the dangers. That information is passed on to the students so they know the risks involved. I'm not often accused of being an optimist, but I do hope that there are also team members who would say, don't use that stuff, man. We're having a great season. We run the risk of blowing it. We run the risk of disqualification. You run the risk of hurting yourself. I do think, and I hope, and Yanni, you let me know if I'm wrong, that there are times where our students stop each other from doing harmful things. Hopefully it happens more often than when they don't. So I would like to see us elevate it to an expulsion hearing type of issue. And then let the board look at the pieces and the nuances and make the determination about what to do in the individual case.
I'm sorry, I forgot to mention when I was speaking that there is concern among students about the health of other students doing steroids, so that is there. But if you have a strong-willed student doing the steroids and they clearly do not care about their health, then it is very hard to approach them or an educator or a captain about it, but there is definitely concern about health among students and teammates.
You know, I'm just going to ask, I know we have some folks that are not involved in this, but perhaps have some observations about this proposed policy, and I would invite anybody from the public to come up and talk to us at this time. Mr. Schofield?
I'm King Schofield. I'm the athletic director of Morro Bay. I've been asked to come and just make some comments, and so I'm just going to give you some overview comments right now, and then I'll be happy to answer questions. But this is what I'm thinking about, okay? First of all, this is a school district, and our mission is an educational mission. And I'm just listening to this discussion, and almost all the discussion is based on the level of penalty that will be issued against students. And yet, I would suggest that the most critical part is thinking about the educational mission. Now, we heard mention of the fact that all coaches are going to be required to have gone through a coach certification course by December of 2008. I know that there's already a couple of us that have been trained in this district to do that training. I just went through that training right before school started. Athletic directors or other people that would train coaches. And so I'd like to remind you about that, first of all, because when you talk about enforcement issues, it's still a question of identifying people who violate the policy. And if your ultimate belief is that you're going to somehow deter people from engaging in steroid use because they're going to be afraid of expulsion, and you listen to Yoni suggesting that students are reluctant now to talk to each other about health issues or bring it before a coach when the issue is a 30-day activity suspension, and then we're going to go to expulsion hearing, that's going to encourage their peers to come forward. I'm thinking that if I was looking at those three options, I would be suggesting that the last one, the athletic contract and the focus on education, is where we ought to be. In the next 2 years, every single coach in the state is going to be trained and certified as with this program and with a key component of education regarding the steroid use policy. And CIF has clearly made a significant emphasis on it in the last couple of years in terms of where they want education to be. I think you should be concerned about due process issues, because to me the only way you're going to have viable enforcement is if you test. And if you test, you're opening up, I think, a huge can of legal worms. And I think we ought to be very careful and look at other districts that have done so and consider how they are exactly establishing something that seems fair across the board. Again, you're talking about, if you're testing, you're talking about identifying those kids that do extra things. You're talking about athletes and other extracurricular activities. Those were the only kids that could even be tested. So you're looking at your general student population. You're worried about drugs, alcohol, and steroid use in your general population. True, athletes, but there's lots of people using steroids who are not athletes for other physically, you know, whatever reasons they think it makes them look better, look more appealing, look more physical. So I don't think you can isolate it to athletes. And when you talk about a testing policy, the only legal ground you have for testing is on extracurricular activities only. And so you're ignoring the bulk of your student body. You're focusing on those kids that are doing extra activities, and you're testing only them. To me, that's a it's a bothersome message, and it doesn't get to the heart of the problem, which is your entire student body. So if you want to focus on athletics, then I think we ought to be educating. What I've started to do this year coming out of this conference that we went to in training is at my expectation meetings, I talk to every single family. Part of this program is just starting to unfold in the state of California. I think in the next 2 years, you're going to see a lot more educational emphasis placed on it. And if I was looking for a directive from the board, I would be looking for encouragement to see what can we do to make the educational component more powerful. Do we want to do something like every single family has to have been exposed to steroid education film at least once, you know, as they come into the school and join the athletic program? Everybody's got to see that film. Everybody's got to sign that they saw it, kids and parents alike. Maybe that's a start. But certainly it drew it to my attention in a way that I probably, you know, I talk about our athletic contract. I talk about honoring that contract with all of our students. But I've started to make a specific focus on the steroid issue now, because it's clear to me that the state of California and CIF and the state are very concerned about that. And when you look at the poll numbers, I was surprised. I don't know if Tom Dimmitt is here or not, but I know Tom was trained as well, and I'm sure he was surprised to hear that they're thinking that there could be as many as 10 or 15% of the athletes in California have tried steroids, and that is of a concern. It's a great concern, but to me, it's almost all decisions made out of ignorance. And not because these guys are all thinking that, you know, I'm going to be the next professional whatever. But I think that education is at the heart of the matter. This is a school district. You're a school board. And I think the more we can do to emphasize the way we educate our students about the risks they take and the consequences, not the expulsion consequences, but the consequences to themselves, their teammates, their culture, to me, those are more pressing issues and much more in line with our educational mission. So that's my little spiel.
Thanks. And I believe the board can entertain the idea of what are we doing about educating anabolic steroids as well as drugs and alcohol, which I know we have supported in the past. I'm thinking there are really two issues that you brought up for me. The first is, what do we do about educating students to the dangers of these kinds of things? The second is, we've got really two classes here. We're saying student athletes who this gives an unfair advantage, may give an unfair advantage to on the athletic fields, essentially cheating. But then you also said then there's another class of students who may be taking steroids who aren't athletes. And I know this is an athletic policy that we're discussing, not the Ed Code suggested that or stated that we need to have a policy opposing steroid use in students.
And I think the policy needs to be there, and I think, in fact, it is. I'm not here to say that we shouldn't think about rewording the way we express our concern. But I think you're right. I think there are two separate issues. There is the extracurricular area, and then there's also the general health of our students, regardless of whether they're engaged in any kind of extracurricular activity or not, and those probably are two separate issues. I did just want to remind you, I don't know if I said this prior or not, but you know, the coach certification program is about educating our coaches and making them more aware of symptoms and effects and, you know, and communicating effectively with their athletes. At expectation meetings, where, you know, there is where we can educate our students and our parents about what we've learned through these programs and maybe even expose them to what we consider to be powerful, whatever kind of medium we think will be most persuasive. But I certainly was persuaded by the film that I saw. And I think that those, you know, I just think it's important to think about the fact that that stuff is coming into place, and whatever encouragement that we would get from our board that would, you know, to direct us in that educational effort, I think would be valuable. I don't know if I answered your question.
I feel like you did. Anybody else from the public who'd like to address us on this issue? Mr. Buckman and Mr. Madrigan.
My name's Mark Buckman, and I'm from San Luis Obispo. We're basically here tonight because the governor signed a piece of legislation this year that required the addition of the sentence at the end of the athletic contract that requires both athletes and parents to sign that they will not use steroids. And I am hearing great discussion, and I'm very happy about this discussion. The one thing that's concerning me is, as often is done in Sacramento, a piece of legislation is signed, there's a requirement handed down to the districts, but no enforcement was put with that. And so you're wrestling with the enforcement part of this. What kind of testing we do? How do we find out whether it's a locker room discussion or not? My concern is one of the issues raised was a possibility of requiring drug testing when asked. And I urge you to shy very far away from that, because my concern is that...
One of the things that concerns me would be the trust issue. As a coach, I'm trusting my students to do what is right. For us to go ahead and say, right off the bat, you're guilty until proven innocent. If we don't have a reason and we go ahead and test students who are doing everything that they're supposed to be doing, they've signed the contract, they're keeping their end of the bargain, and then we send the message that still we are going to test you anyways, then I think that sends the wrong message to our students. So we're not just talking athletes, we're talking band members, we're talking a lot of students who are our ambassadors for our school. I think it's insulting, I think it's demeaning, and I think we're gonna end up with some legal issues if we go ahead and force this upon our students. Thanks.
Mr. Jones.
Good evening, Will Jones, principal of San Luis Obispo High School. First of all, I'm concerned that for anyone in the public who's watching this board meeting, they might have the impression that use of steroids is a serious problem at our schools, and I don't believe that's the case. We are spending a lot of time on this issue, and it's an important issue, but in the time I've been principal and in the 18 years I've been at the high school, we have not had a single case of an athlete who has been brought forward with a case of having used steroids. That doesn't mean that it's not a serious issue. We shouldn't address it seriously, but I hope that no one in the public gets the impression that we have a big problem with that. Second of all, in looking at the consequence that already exists for athletes, for most of us, 30 days seems like a heartbeat or a blink. For a student athlete, 30 days within a given season is like a lifetime. In terms of the amount of competition that they would miss with a suspension of that nature. And depending on when that happens during the season, if that were brought forward, that would, in essence, be the duration of the season. And so I think it is a substantial consequence and a heartbreaking consequence for a student, one that sends a strong message. I have a serious concern, given the fact that we have spent many, many years, if not decades, trying to educate students about the problems that occur with alcohol and drug use and use of any kind of drugs. I have a concern that we would take one banned substance and raise it to a level of concern that if we are too swift to judgment on issues like this, then we burn bridges and we don't have an opportunity to help that young person grow through this kind of a problem if it exists. So I would be in favor of maintaining the policy that we have, which gives us the 30-day suspension from athletic participation, and giving us an opportunity to educate and also maybe provide some intervention for that student as they continue to move through the school system in their educational and athletic career.
Thank you all. Your comments were very helpful. Even though I've heard a couple of things that were a little bit disturbing, I was kind of approaching this issue as a case where we don't have a major problem at either one of our comprehensive high schools with steroid use. And that's why I wasn't proposing a drug testing program. I do like the reservation of the right to request a drug test, I'm not suggesting we set up, you know, steroid snitch boxes in the locker rooms or anything. What I'm suggesting is this education component, which, by the way, folks, is a significant portion of the policy. Coaches shall educate students. I'm going to recommend we include parents and guardians about the district's prohibition and the dangers of using steroids and other performance-enhancing supplements. Administrative regulations can do just what you suggested that we do, that the parents and the students sit down, watch the presentation, acknowledge that. I guess I would be open to the 30-day part of it. And I do agree with Will that is a significant penalty for a student. I guess what I'm reacting to in part of my mind and heart, and it's not formed very well, and it's really the Barry Bonds thing. I mean, it's kind of the wink and the nod and, we're still cheering for the home runs, even though, some significant portion of the population believes that, that he's not playing fair. And I don't want to be complicit in that message. Mandatory expulsion departs from the way we handle some of the other drugs, but what I was trying to do was to reserve the right for the board to do the careful consideration of what to do about the particular student. They said a group of our students are some of the best kids we've got, some of the highest achievers and most focused and committed. But they're also, as we've seen over and over again, mature young adults who can understand complex messages that the people who are in charge of their education and their well-being can communicate to them. So I guess where I come down on is, yes, I hope the educational component does it. I always tend to want to trust staff. The first line folks, the kids far better than we do. So I'm open to, depending on how my colleagues feel, about some form of staff intervention initially. But what do you do? I want to just clarify my position. I don't want to establish a testing program. I do want staff to have be in the contract, assuming that it's an appropriate and legal way to approach it, have the right on the basis of suspicion or concern to request a test. And I'm open to what we do if we get a situation where we have a positive.
Thank you, Chris. I think that the discussion tonight has helped clarify some feelings, some issues, but I think the overriding message is that there's a concern by the people here tonight and probably the majority of parents that this is a problem that hasn't been discussed enough, that it has been ignored at all levels, and now here's an opportunity to establish something that may have a direct effect and benefit students, which is really what we're all here to do, is try to help and assist students in making decisions that will affect them for the rest of their lives. So in that regard, I think if we look at this policy, taking the beginning paragraph and using the first paragraph, which basically follows what the code is now for an athlete, and establish, let's say, a six-month period in, say, March of next year, that we bring back the athletic directors and the principals who are most involved with the athletic programs at the high schools, and that during this time there's a development of an educational program to more effectively communicate the issues relative to steroid use in addition to alcohol and drugs for both the parents and the students and the coaches, which are the future will be better defined and more helpful to the students. So at least there's a system in place that would address any issues if something obvious comes up, which is in place now. And I think the idea of bringing it before the board, before there's further analysis and direction from the athletic directors and the principals and the administration, may be putting the cart before the horse until we know exactly what education will do, which I think was a great suggestion, how the parents respond and what issues arise with students understanding that this is an issue that the district takes seriously, that the board is going to revisit in March. And then at that point, we may have more anecdotal information. We may have more to establish a program that's more comprehensive than what we're able to do tonight.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. So essentially, we would go with paragraphs 1, 2, and 3, revisit the actual And for the 30 days? Okay. And for revisit the proposed policy in about 6 months. An interest I have is looking at how the administrative regulations are going to be developed and what we do about the due process, and then thinking about what Mr. Schofield said, perhaps where we talk about coaches shall educate students, perhaps parents and caregivers as well. And then I'm wondering if it's too all-encompassing or not. However, perhaps we want to make a statement that all students shall be educated about the dangers of steroids. And make it a more of a blanket message about the danger of it, but because we're trying to align ourselves with CIF regulations and Ed Code, ultimately focusing it on athletes at this point. And then
Can I ask for some clarification?
Sure, please.
You didn't mean by your summary to leave out the paragraph related to coaches shall educate the students?
No.
Okay.
No, absolutely not.
And the paragraph below that regarding sponsorships or donations from
supplements. That's correct. I was suggesting that perhaps we insert some language about coaches shall educate students, parents, and caregivers.
Good. I like that.
And then making a statement that a blanket statement about all students at our schools shall be educated about the dangers of anabolic steroids and supplements. And then Mrs. Botwin and Mrs. Roger.
All right. I was going to go based on incorporating what you and John said together. I'm all in favor of having...
Given that you've only recently received the training, I don't know who got it at San Luis or Laguna or Los Osos Middle School.
Mr. Eklund over there.
Mr. Eklund got it.
Tom Dimmitt was involved in the training. He did our first coaching class for coaches at San Luis Obispo High School. Mr. Schofield will be starting that up at Morro Bay. We have a two-year period, but we're working to try to get our coaches all certified under the new training over the course of this next year, year and a half.
So, Rick, am I confused, or did Mr. Dimmitt retire?
He did, but he's working for us doing the training.
He's working for us doing the training.
Yeah,
okay.
He was real proactive and got the training about a year ago and started doing some activities at the school surrounding it. And so he was our first trained.
So we have Mr. Dimmitt, Mr. Schofield. I guess what I'm leading up to here is our objective is to have all of our coaches trained by December of 2008.
That's the requirement. Our objective is to have it done faster than that.
Okay, that would be truly wonderful. I'm wondering if, given that we have only two people currently trained, is March a reasonable date to establish an educational, the guidelines for an educational program?
It's a trainer of trainers model, and so we have two individuals who are trained to teach the course. It's a pretty extensive course. It takes about 8 to 10 hours, involves tests. It's done on like two Saturday mornings or over a course of several evenings. So we have two individuals within our district trained as trainer of trainers to do that. I would imagine we will not have all of our coaches trained by March because some of the difficulties are trying to schedule a class during a sportive season where coaches are already, their Saturdays are all occupied, their evenings are occupied. So the goal is to look at maybe mid-year or this time of year, ideally next year, to have our cycle of coaches trained. So I don't think we'd have everyone trained by then. That doesn't mean we couldn't entertain a discussion and have some feedback about that.
Well, I'm just wondering, we're asking, if I understand correctly, for them to come back to us with some kind of an educational model that they would like to use. No? John, help me out here.
What I was suggesting, and of course this is all subject to input from everyone who's more involved, definitely, but we check in again in March to find out how the training is going, how the educational program is going with the students, and how incorporated that is relative to parents and guardians.
Okay, I knew that we weren't asking for all the coaches to be trained, but I just thought that there was we were asking for more of an educational program to be developed. If that's not the case, then I guess March maybe is a reasonable time frame for them to come back to us and tell us how it's going working with the parents and the kids. in discussions about steroid use and the dangers of steroid use. Okay, thank you.
It doesn't sound like we have to have a educational thing developed for us. It already is developed. You know, they've got the trainers and the programs planned.
So, okay.
Can I get to you just a minute? Because I want to make sure that Mr. Robinette is real clear about what it is that we'd be proposed, what you'll be moving, because I'm a little confused. So, Mr. Robinette, what's your, or somebody help us out, what's our understanding of what we would actually be voting on tonight? If that's okay with you, Caroline?
Yeah, probably. Kim would be the best person, I think, to.
Dr. Valentine?
I can tell you based on what I've heard, but I, you know. What I'm understanding, or at least it sounds like a motion will be presented to have paragraphs 1, 2, 3, and 4, the underlined 4 that says a restriction of a minimum of 30 days, which is consistent with our current athletic policy and conduct code, and skipping down in the last two paragraphs with the addition of where it says coaches shall educate students, we include coaches shall educate students, parents, and caregivers about the district's prohibition. And also probably in that same sentence adding a sentence that says all students shall be educated about the dangers of anabolic steroid use, or somewhere within the body of this, including an all statement instead of just student athletes. And I'm assuming this is high school students or...
I think guardian is a better word than caregiver. Guardian implies a legal power.
My special ed talk. Dr. Matakovich, did you have a comment?
That's what my understanding is, but I'm not...
Yeah, sure. Just a comment about education. We have health as a requirement that students take at the ninth grade level, and this is a component of their instructional program. So all students are educated relative to drugs and to steroids.
Our conduct code, I mean, in a sense, this is treated like a controlled substance, and so with any controlled substance, we have to follow our conduct code, give due process, have the appeal rights, the suspension. It kind of triggers up to the assistant superintendent, ultimately to the superintendent. Expulsion issues obviously come before the board. So I think there's guarantees of due process within our current policies, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Matakovich.
Will we support... will we support testing for anabolic steroids for our students, though, based on suspicion, is, I guess, really my fundamental question here. Where does the testing come in? Who pays for it? Well, it is an issue, I think. I'd like some assurance that this is taken care of. Okay.
Well, I would suggest that we take action on expulsions based on reasonable suspicion, and that plenty of times. You know,
well, the other question I have is, okay, if as Mr. Jones suggested, 30 days is a long time in the life of a student athlete. Could be a student athlete season. It could be during that time that the scout from UCLA is there to look at the student. If we deprive a student of 30 days of participation based on rumor and innuendo, we could essentially be denying this student the future that they had hoped for, the future that their parents had hoped for, or invested in the case of elite athletes.
I'm confused a little bit.
I want to make sure that we have addressed the issue of how are we going to support the found piece of it. We have not supported paying for drug tests in the past, and so I just would like to make sure that if we're going to be doing this and taking this away from students, that we have a way of ensuring that in fact the student did what they were accused of doing.
I know in the past that some students have been suspended for alcohol usage, drug usage. So that process worked in terms of what the procedure or what took place. I don't know if tonight we have to fully define found there may be a specific issue.
Say, hey, you know, we got a problem. We don't have a... So I'm going to go ahead and move that we approve the policy, the new student, the new proposed new student board policy 5131.63, personnel steroids, as it is now, with the exceptions that were listed, and that we meet again in March, bring this back in March for a brief presentation discussion by the coaches, anybody else who wants to get involved in it, what were they able to do in the educational aspect, which we were primarily concerned with, and then go further if we need to, or step back if we need to.
And I would support this with the caveat, again, that the board understands what specifically we're going to be doing about children who are suspected. And I think, Yoni, you had some comments, too, before we take before I look for a second for this.
I had a question, but I think I'm going to let you guys make your motion and do all that stuff because it's not very relevant to this kind of motion. So yeah, I'll ask it afterwards.
Sorry. It's been moved by Mrs. Botwin and seconded by Mr. Spadafore. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Carries 7-0.
Thank you.
I had a question. It was relevant a while ago, and it's still kind of relevant with the mention of due process. I had a question for, I think, Mr. Robinette. I don't know who the expert is on the actual drug tests, but the test for anabolic steroids, is there a possibility that that drug test could turn up other drugs that a student has taken?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I know that the only experience I have is with the Templeton folks, and they do they require two tests if a student is found with a substance, an illegal substance or a banned substance in their body. They have a follow-up test using a more advanced type of testing. And it's still a urinalysis, but it's gas spectrometry or something that does it. But my understanding is that it tests the tests they use are for various substances, most of which leave the body quickly, some of which marijuana stays in the body a long time, about 75 days. So
my follow-up,
a lot of things.
My follow-up question is, if a student is accused of anabolic steroids and takes the drug test and is found to have taken other drugs, can the board take action on these drug findings? And
those are doing random drug testing. I mean, obviously schools doing it, but I think it's rare that districts are doing that.
Well, Yoni's question, though, is to me, if we require somebody to take a test for anabolic steroids and it turns out they got pot in their urine, are they in trouble now for pot, not anabolic steroids? So it's a good question.
If I could jump in on that. The board's responsible for honoring the due process rights of a student, and so is administration for that matter, no matter what the offense is. There is no way that anybody is empowered to not do due process. Where it gets sticky is when we don't understand what due process is because the matters become complicated, a la Yanni's question. What we've done in the past is that when we get into those circumstances, we do not go into them without some kind of legal counsel and advice to also back the board's conversation so that we are not left having to make kind of uninformed decisions about whether a youngster is culpable for violating school rules if that wasn't what you were testing for to begin with and those kinds of questions.
All right, shall we move on to item number 6? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Peter, I apologize.
Just a quick follow-up comment. I wanted to explain my vote there because I did vote with the majority on that after coming here thinking that I was going to more favor the stronger language, the second paragraph. I still favor strong language on this topic, but after hearing the comments from the experts, from Mr. Scoville, Mr. Bedrigian, the coaches that are out there, I just wanted to say that I think we should look at this again, as we will in March or later on. And if we do have a problem, I think we should consider going back to stronger language. But, it was good to hear the feedback from the experts and from the other board members, and I just wanted to make that point.
And shall we move on to item number 6, which is biennial review of district conflict of interest code
Dr. Valentine?
Yeah, I want to thank Ms. Holmes for preparing this item for the board tonight. We're essentially doing a cleanup piece regarding requirements of conflict of interest reporting. We find that based on our legal advice that we have a redundancy of having the requirements defined in two places, and so part of the recommendation tonight is to eliminate one of the places where it occurs and to rely entirely on the board body.
Peter, discussion.
Yes, thank you. I have a question here. What I thought we had discussed this months ago, that anytime we get something changed, we're going to get the old with the cross out and the new with the underlines.
We did?
Which one is the new one then? Okay, and then the old one? I apologize. I never got to the back part of this section, so excuse me.
Any other discussion on this matter? Other discussion? Anybody from the public? Okay. It's been moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Peter. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 7-0. It's been suggested by Mr. Spatafore, and I was thinking it's probably a good idea. Why don't we take a five-minute break before we delve into item number 7? And let's just make it, shall we say, can we take, Walter, you got that look. Can we take 5?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, I'm just a board member.
That's right.
5 minutes?
Do we need 5 minutes?
Yes. I think, thank you. We'll take a five-minute break, and if you could set the timer and... Let's get back into session here. Mr. Peter is here. Ah, Mrs. Roger has come back to the room.
Marilyn, give me a
Mr. Spatafore.
Here. I think the last
you
one.
Want it?
The cookies are the cookies are gone.
Okay. Yeah. Because I don't like them crispy. No, it's all gone. I know. Thank you. So, thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Shall we get started on item number 7?
Yes.
Okay. This is a further discussion of the Johnson Avenue property. Property project definition, Mr. Parker.
Good evening. As we said, we brought back three possible project definitions for the board to consider this evening. We included some pros and cons for each. We'd hope that you have a good discussion about the pros and cons and that you can arrive on a definition for this project that best meets the board's interests. And with that, I'll just keep my staff report short.
You know what? Before we start down here with Mrs. Botwin, Mr. Peter, you always go last.
Yeah.
And so the first shall be last if you'd like to
go
now.
Good idea.
Shall be first. I'm sorry.
I have some data that I pulled together this afternoon that I think we should all just have. It's not meant to make any particular point, but I think it's worth having in advance of this discussion. So, as part of the various materials that we've received about the Johnson Avenue property and how we might create an affordable a fund to co-purchase homes with teachers or our staff, some assumptions were made, and they were basically that a teacher or a staff member could purchase a home in the area for $450,000, and if we loaned $100,000 on that with a combined income of $75,000, Brad, you can correct me if I have the figures wrong, that they would be able to afford a mortgage on that property. And therefore, by selling the property at whatever value, we could help so many teachers or so many staff members. I say teachers, but I mean staff. So I thought it would be interesting to run some data and just see what sort of categories of housing are available within our community at that price. And I hope the information was up to date. I went to Ashton Data's MLS system. But let me just read you some of the information. In the county, because it's very interesting, in the county there are a total of 362 units available that are priced under $450,000. 18 three-bedroom condominiums, 72-bedroom condominiums, and I counted one-bedroom condos out thinking that, you know, our average staff member would like to have at least a place for the mother-in-law to stay or the grandparents to stay or something. Yeah. But 18 three-bedroom condos, 72-bedroom condos, 171 three-bedroom single-family residences, and 103 two-bedroom single-family residences. So a total of 362 units, but I don't think this is going to be a surprise to anybody, but very, very few of those homes exist within our district. Very few. In the MLS system, there's 10, so we have some for the, yeah, is up to date. But I thought it was useful to consider, because the items that we're going to talk about tonight, the three projects, whether we build affordable by design or affordable housing or rezone the property and sell it, two of the options talk about the ability to build 38 units on the Johnson Avenue property. And so this sort of puts in context for me what those 38 units could mean in terms of workforce housing when we really only have 55 total units, you know, today, on the market today. This isn't talking about 2 or 3 years down the road when we might be able to actually take action if we move forward tonight. But there are only 55 units within our district, within, you know, Morbay and San Luis available that are in that category today. So I guess my summary is I think we probably have a pretty big issue. We have a pretty big problem, because it's going to be really difficult for our staff to be able to afford these homes because the supply is so few, unless they're willing to go north or south or inland or somewhere. But so my thought was, you know, boy, it's great to have teachers and firefighters and police living within our communities, and I think that's something that we should encourage. So, you know, my initial thought coming to the meeting was, let's just sell this thing, highest, best value, take the money, and use it for co-purchasing homes with teachers. But when I saw how many or how few there are available within our community, it caused me to think that maybe we should really consider a couple of these other options. Now, I'm not sure that Johnson Avenue is necessarily the best site to build a project, and I'd like to ask, you know, the district about what some of the restrictions are on the money. If we were to sell Johnson Avenue and generate the type of money that we're talking about, $4 or $5 million, depending on how it's zoned, are there other sites within the district that might be more appropriate for us to either build housing, workforce housing for our staff, or to even partner with some other entity? Mark suggested some entities that we should consider at the last meeting, and I think, you know, that merits potentially further investigation.
If I understand your question, are there other sites that the district owns,
yes,
that would be more appropriate?
Right.
That's a discussion that we've not undertaken with the board. We have closed school sites.
Right.
The old Pacheco campus on Grand Avenue, Sunnyside in Los Osos, and Moore Elementary School. And we will be bringing some additional discussion
from any money we would generate from the sale of the property. So assuming we went forward and rezoned for single-family housing and were able to sell it for $5 million, do we still have to pay the million to reconfigure?
That
in other words, our net is $4 million?
No, that is net.
That is net. Okay.
$5 million.
Okay. That's, I think, all I want to say for now. I may have comments in a bit.
Thank you. I appreciate this. And guys, bear with me, because I missed the last meeting, but I did read the booklet from cover to cover. And I also watched as much of the film as I could see before you guys ran out and said, okay. Couple of things. I really feel at this point, although this work has been done and well done, I really feel we're putting the cart before the horse. In this sense, we're looking to find some way to help teachers who are coming new to this district, and to help them find and or buy homes. And we've never ever sat down and discussed that in itself. What other options are there except sell the Johnson Avenue property and build up there or whatever? And there's all kinds of other things, and I think Peter told me today or yesterday that he Bruce Bedrygian made some suggestion to him that we, in bringing in more seasoned teachers, if we up the step and bring them in at step 15. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. And then you talk to him afterward. I'm sorry, I got the two overlapped. Okay, bringing him in at step 15. And then I got thinking about that, and I thought, well, that's a very small step from there to bring in the brand new teachers. And let's say we used to have, for example, sabbaticals years ago in this district, many years ago. And a sabbatical is where you work so many years, you earn the time off, you get paid your salary while you're gone. You have to come back for 3 years in order to keep the payments that you got. If you leave before the 3 years after the sabbatical are up, you have to repay it. Okay, so, and I thought, gosh, get a brand new teacher, bring them in, and it takes about 3 years for them to get tenure. Once they hit tenure, we give them a $25,000, $30,000 bonus, whatever amount to be determined, and they may have that to use for a house down payment or anything else, actually, and they have to remain for 3 years and not get fired. They have to remain for 3 years in order to keep that. And on the new hires you had down here for approximately 20, let's say 20 new hires a year for the past, since 2001, approximately 20,000 a year. And of those, I figured out that about six or seven are brand new. All right, we're talking six or seven a year, brand new. All right, we set up the program for them. Then the others are wonderfully, as the district's been noted for doing, are older teachers that have more background, more teaching experience. And if we up that from step 10, is that the limit now, step 10 for bringing in, and up it to 15, maybe even to 18. And that would give them the necessary funds where they could go wherever they needed to go. Also, this just occurred to me when Peter was talking before, when David was talking before, that most of our teachers now don't live in San Luis. Most of them, many of them are in Atascadero and have lived there for years. Many live in Arroyo Grande, Morro Bay, some in Cayucas, and some in so on. So if we, you know, why is it a big priority to get them here, get them on Johnson Avenue and fence them in? Unless we're afraid we're going to lose them. But my thinking is this whole plan, although it's wonderful and well-organized and well-written and well-thought-out, is very, very early. It's not something I want to deal with. Your recommendation at the end of it is the Board of Education provides staff with direction on which project to create at Johnson Avenue. That's the only one there. Number two, I would add, or not to develop the Johnson Avenue property. And number three, I would add, to look at other properties. For example, and I called and talked to Russell and a number of other people, Pacific Beach. What kind of location is that? It is a marvelous location. We have other places where we can relocate Pacific Beach, and then the building is can use some upkeep too. But we have approximately 5 acres over there on Los Osos Valley Road. If we wanted to build houses or go to lease the land, get somebody else and build the houses, they're adjacent to a housing division right there. The houses are right behind them all the way around. If we, the old Pacheco, there's a real possibility over there. Those are rentals. We're renting them out at the time. They're set up as schools at the time in different buildings, and we could work out these things. None of these things have been discussed, and that's why I'm frustrated. We haven't discussed anything else, but are we gonna sell or build on the property that's not quite in the center of a campus? I think that's foolishness. I think we're just putting the cart right before the horse, and we don't need to. We don't need the money at this time. let's keep on looking at this project instead of going slam bang right into it. Thank you for bearing with me.
Mr. Spadafore, and then Mr. Millar, and then Mrs. Dickinson.
Thanks, Chris. I had some questions to get some more information tonight from everyone who's here, including Mr. Del Martini, who was on the 7-Eleven committee. Regarding the deed-restricted housing, which would be the only way to address affordable housing, and just as a comment, I know that the city of San Luis Obispo has talked about affordable housing, but I don't think much has ever been done in terms of that, except for what probably was being done by the authority, the housing authority, George Moylan. So if you direct it to the negatives that it said, where it says the district must finance construction, what I was unsure of, is there the possibility of partnership agreements with government entities to develop funds for building affordable housing by deed restriction?
Let me just respond to one part of it. I've had several meetings with Carol Hadley, the director of, Housing Authority, and most of their programs are Section 8 federally funded programs, in which case the income restrictions are...
Yeah, no, I know about Section 8 because you have to have economic limitations before you go. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about we have a $15 to $20 million development cost of this area, and one of the cons is the financing of it.
Yes.
So I was talking about, are there any programs that don't have those restrictions, because we're looking at assisting staff potentially for housing when they come to the district and are obviously aren't able to afford the average that David was so, you know, he helped provide that information.
Yeah, I was just going to address that particular portion of it, and then I was going to ask one of our other folks to come up and talk about other possibilities.
Now there's no program for tax credit financing or any kind of public partnership for development of housing, as where the city of San Luis Obispo is the entity that's involved. We work with the housing authority on those issues. So sometimes we partner with the housing authority in terms of providing them funds through our affordable housing fund that we collect when there's new developments and we get fees and those types of things. So I hope that answers your question.
So you don't know of any funds that are available to partner on affordable housing projects other than what you just mentioned?
That's correct. The city of San Luis Obispo, what we have is an affordable housing fund that, you know, the value of that fund is probably somewhere $1.5 to $2 million at this point. And, you know, the school board could, you know, request some of those funds to facilitate a project, and there's criteria for when the city would allocate funds for an affordable housing project. But I'm not sure that there's a sufficient amount in that fund to really make a difference in this project.
Has the city done anything to streamline the cost of the process of going to a development like that in terms of reducing costs?
Yes.
Or of cutting the requirements that cost more money for that type of a...
Well, your application fees are a small portion of the overall cost, but they are waived in the event that it is a, you know, affordable housing project. And if it's a percentage affordable housing project, then there's a pro rata share that's of the fees that are waived. Impact fees are waived for every affordable unit that are created, which is a significant amount of money, $18,000 to $20,000 per unit. But again, those are probably smaller costs with respect to the overall project.
Are you aware of any federal programs?
I'm not.
Okay. And then the other question I had, thanks very much, is the second point that the district must manage the project for its life, if that's the direction. If you have deeds that are jointly owned between a school district and an individual, is the management falling upon the school district on all occasions? And can fees be charged to the people who are in that development to manage their own?
There certainly could be chargeback to manage the program. And you're speaking of a program that would be like the Cal Poly H8 Bella Montana program, where we would retain ownership of the land, we would sell the improvements to an employee, and that would be deed restricted based upon a COLA. We would have to manage it in that we are essentially, again, that is something that could be contracted out. Carol Hatley with the Housing Authority said that that could be a service they could provide us, management of a district-owned project like that for a fee. And whether that fee was passed on to the homeowner, which in case, of course, doesn't help the affordability of the home, would have to be determined.
Okay, and then the next page where it says employees would not build equity like traditional ownership, there's equity developing, but it's limited.
It's
based
limited.
Upon a formula. So there would be some equity development.
Not like a traditional ownership. It would be a limited amount of equity. In some respects, you'd get some tax benefits while you were living there, and you would get, I suppose you could look at it as saving your rent.
Okay. Okay. And then the high cost of entitlement, the next point is affected somewhat because the city does make concessions or assists in the entitlement process with that type of a project.
Good evening, Carol Florence. It's nice to see you all again. I forget it's been 2 years since you authorized me to assist you with this project. There are certain aspects that the city has jurisdiction to waive fees, if you will, but then there are other certain aspects of the entitlement process or the permit process that unfortunately they don't have the ability to do, and one of those has to do with the California Environmental Quality Act. If you move forward with the 38-unit project, a lot subdivision project, all of those are considered projects under CEQA, and that review can be as limited as a negative declaration or more in-depth, and an environmental impact report would need to be prepared. And these days, those are unfortunately or fortunately, depending upon your perspective, six-figure documents.
And then the low-cost housing potential in terms of the affordable housing, that does not change those requirements at all?
No, it really doesn't. I think there's an expectation that is just part of the law whenever you develop a piece of property.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And then I don't have any other questions. I was just going to mention that my concern is that we still
then sort of moved over into what we do with the money or the property or some aspect of that and how we can impact recruiting and retention. The most interesting idea about the recruiting and retention piece that I've heard in a while was from Mr. Bedrigian last meeting about what does happen when we change the maximum number of years of experience that we'll recruit in. And I mean, we may be able to recruit in more senior teachers with an income level and, you know, in a financial position where they can more readily afford housing. And also, I think, and Dave, you again amazed me just your homework and your analysis, analytical approach to this. I'm glad you're here. It seems to me that the idea of doing something where we're trying to get the teachers to live or staff to live in the city is short-sighted and perhaps unrealistic. And I mean, if we add 38 units to the housing when you only have, 55 units in the city, I mean, we're really impacting the dynamics of the real estate market to some extent there. And I've always favored more if we want to use the proceeds from the surplus property to impact the recruiting and retention issue, we do it through dollars and financial assistance rather than getting into the housing business. And to some extent, it's probably unrealistic to think that we can keep that recruiting and making the teachers and staff live in the city might be unrealistic. So, you know, I don't know what to do with this, but it does bother me that we have a piece of property that represents a significant value and can be used to educate. I mean, the recruiting and retention part of it's a great idea and goal and everything, but we have an obligation to marshal the assets of our school district and apply them to the education of the students who are here today and who are going to be here in the future, and this is part of that stewardship to me. And it's, and if it turns out we don't really have a realistic way of impacting teacher recruitment or staff recruitment through this real estate stuff, then so be it. It is what it is. But we still have the issue of what are we going to do with this surplus property and what can we do with the money, the proceeds from it. And that still excites me.
If we want to help teachers, you know, that we would do a different thing probably. We would either, you know, do one of these deed-restricted housing things. And so I think that it's very important for us to be clear what we want to do. That Avila thing kind of boomeranged a little bit because the community thought we were developing staff housing, and then it turned out to be really not the case in their perception, it seemed to me. So we don't want to be in the position of pretending it's to help teachers, but we're really just trying to, you know, ask how exciting it is to sell property for a lot of money and what we can do with it, you know. So I think we need to, and I'm hearing some people talking about the teacher part, and you're talking about the revenue coming in. So we think we as a group need to decide what we want to do exactly. I like the idea of attracting teachers and letting them have their years that they've worked. And I think that is really important if we're interested in the teacher part of it, which would be very effective and would be much less expensive than selling property. I think that the figures here about one plan could assist 40 employees, the $4 million, and one could assist 50 employees every 5 years buy a home. I'm glad Mr. Peter brought up the reality of how much homes cost. And I'm a little worried about the elite nature of that plan because it requires a teacher or a staff person to have a significant other who's bringing in enough money that they at least reach $75,000. And I still think that it's very difficult to find anything that they would want to live in a way. I don't know. I think it's underestimating how hard it is to find any kind of affordable house here. So we don't want to just set up a situation where we can help teachers who are married or have someone who's helping them with expenses. And I really like Mr. Spadafore's reminder that we were trying to do what's best for students. And of course, you know, this came up, well, you know, what's good for teachers is good for students, but not necessarily. And what's best for students is really our focus. And I'm still not convinced that leaving the property as is not best for the most of the students. And that
Mr. Peter?
I hope I didn't imply when I asked presented the data before that I was necessarily in favor of the district building and managing a housing complex. In fact, I'm not. I don't think that's the business we should be in. The reason I asked the question, though, about what other properties were available is if we head down the path of selling the property, which I think we would all agree would probably, or rezoning it for 14 single-family homes and selling it, that would bring the highest value, that as we go through that process and ultimately sell the project, we're going to generate funds that are going to go into the building and maintenance fund. And that would give us the flexibility, should we at some point in the next 2 years decide that, hey, we do want to build houses or we want to co-purchase homes with our employees. I think we'll have that flexibility should we decide later on. And I think the only option that affords us that flexibility is if we sell the property outright at its highest value, which would be to rezone it for 14 single-family lots.
And I'm in support of the 14 single-family lots. I look at $5 million, and that's a lot of money. I look at 50 employees being helped every 5 years, potentially, and that's a significant number of employees that could be helped continuously rather than say, looking at 38 and closed, because really that's what we're talking about. I'm here, and that's it. I get lucky, I win the lottery, and I get to stay here the rest of my life. The other thing, though, that's intriguing to me is something that Caroline said, and I've put this on sort of the back burner for a while. But I think we do need to look at our other properties, and I think one of the properties that we will want to look at is the Pacific Beach property, and whether that's an appropriate place for us to have a school. Now, that's not part of this discussion, particularly about Johnson Avenue, but certainly if we're going to be looking at maximizing revenues and finding appropriate places for our students to go to school, I think that and the Pacheco discussion and some other things are going to be very appropriate, especially in light of the projected revenue in the southern part of San Luis Obispo and the impact that that's going to have on Hawthorne School. So I am in favor of the 14R1 single family lots. I am in favor of the 7-Eleven Committee's recommendation, and I am also in favor of looking at other alternatives for our properties in San Luis. Mrs. Dickett?
Property and put that money into helping teachers buy homes and keep the Johnson Avenue. I mean, to me, it's worth $200,000 a year for Dr. Valentine to have a good view. Keep his vision as our superintendent. Not to mention Russell and Mary and Kim. And the students. I know Russell's like, I mean, Walter's putting his hands in his face, but... I don't think it's excess. I think it's good the way it is, and I would rather do our same goal a slightly different way.
And Mrs. Botwin, and then I think I'll ask that we, I think everybody's pretty much indicated where they're going to land on this issue, and except for, oh, I didn't see your microphone down. I apologize. Mrs. Botwin, and then Mrs. Roger.
The final comment I have to make, or there's several of them actually, is that I remember years and years and years ago, well, actually not too many years ago, maybe 10 years ago, we had $10 million in savings when Dr. Denton was here. And we kept talking as a board about what are we going to do to, we're spending too much money. We have to pull back in, and no, we're fine. He said, do you guys remember the saying that he said all the time, we're going to have a soft landing? Anybody remember hearing that, soft landing? Well, we did have a soft landing because he was gone. As soon as that last million of the 10 million that we had in saving was gone, so was he. And oh, this is true. You were here too, Walder. You remember soft landings? Well, maybe we don't remember exactly the same way, but nonetheless, it happens. If my husband gives me a present at Christmas, as he did on occasion, and a couple thousand dollars, a month later it was gone. And everything I spent it on was wonderful. It was purposeful. It was intelligent. But I never would have spent it if I didn't have it. So I'm two things. I agree with Adrienne and Peter's sort of in between there that David, that perhaps that land on Johnson Avenue is something that we can save for posterity and or down the road if the need ever arises. It's a backup. But at this end, the property is going to go on and get increasingly more valuable. But at this time, for us, when we don't need the money.
But my feelings haven't changed. I don't quite understand how Pacific Beach became a part of this discussion. We weren't looking to sell, or I haven't been a party to any discussions where we've been looking to sell properties currently in use. This had to do with a parcel of land that we have that is undeveloped and is not generating any revenue for us. We have the money, as I said last time, we have the money now to go forward with the entitlements. A subsequent board downstream may not enjoy the same financial picture that we do at this time. My preference would be to sell it for its highest and best, which would be the 14 lots. And then we have certainly had much discussion about employer-assisted housing. I have great interest in that. It may be that that doesn't pan out for us for whatever reason. We can't help enough employees. Um, there may be other educational needs that we want to use it for, but I still really would like to keep that employer-assisted housing thing on the front burner. For me, it shows that we care. And I don't think that it's realistic to put our staff in the center of San Luis Obispo. I can't afford to live in the center of San Luis Obispo. I don't think most people in this room can, but it's not unrealistic to expect somewhat of a commute to your workplace. And so if you're able to get a buy-in somewhere in the area around the place where you work, I think that it creates a sense of roots, and I think it will aid us in retention. So my feelings haven't changed from the last time we discussed this. I vote to go, or my sense or my feeling is I'd like to go forward while we have the money to do it and entitle the property for the 14 lots.
Thanks, Chris. I wanted to explore those questions about the deed-restricted housing just to clarify some of my own thoughts. But I really believe when you have the 7-Eleven process to look at excess property, there's a reason for it. And for employee assistance housing, which I think is a great idea because realistically a lot of people who come to this district, whether they're veteran teachers or other staff people or new teachers out of college, are still going to have difficulty finding homes in the core of San Luis Obispo, and that's just a reality. But they may have a more difficult chance of finding it within a 15-mile radius unless there's some assistance, and this money will be available, and I think we've discussed that before. So I believe that when you have property that's passed through the 7-Eleven process and it's excess, and we can use it to assist employees, which will obviously assist students or enhance programs in other ways, that's something that I'm very supportive of. And I wanted to see ways to have affordable housing created because I think in San Luis that's been discussed for a long time and it's never come to any type of reality. And I'm sad in a way that there's this opportunity and we're not going to see it here, but it's quite obvious that the district isn't going to do the additional work that has to be done for the reduced income for something that is a bigger issue for the entire community to address, not just the school district, unfortunately. So my feeling tonight is that I would support the entitlement process for the highest and best proceeds to the district.
Thank you. John, I agree with everything you said. I just wanted to reiterate a couple of pieces of data, too, going back to my data. A couple of weeks ago, I originally requested information about recruitment and retention because, for me, the heart of the issue here is do we really have a problem recruiting teachers and staff members and, I think, even more importantly, keeping them. I don't think there's anything more disruptive than having a churn of employees that you train and they become part of the educational community and then they leave. And so I really wanted to understand whether or not we have that issue or whether or not we have that problem. And I think, the data you all have in front of you, you can draw your own conclusions. But we have seen in the last 6 years since we began tracking that data that we have, there is some turnover among new employees that we've hired that would have brought into the district and have subsequently left. Since the last board meeting, I've had the opportunity to ask 8 teachers, sort of anecdotally, I've seen them around the community or on a school campus, if they knew anybody personally who had left the district for affordability reasons. And each and every one of them could recount a story. I was surprised to hear this information because honestly I was skeptical, but several of them said yes, they knew people who had left and cited affordability as an issue. And one of them was Mr. Pruitt. I asked Kyle Pruitt himself why he was leaving. And staff members coming into our district, which is something we haven't seen before. We know that we have a third of our teaching staff that's going to be retiring in the coming years, that we are prepared to deal with the issue if it arises. And I think it's smart and prudent to be prepared to do that. And that means we need to sell the property now. So then in 4 or 5 years, as we go through that hiring process, we have the ability to take action.
And what I'm seeing is I believe there are 5 votes that are going to be for the entitlement of the property for the 14 and 2 that are probably going to be no. I know, Mrs. Botwin, if you have some final comments, and then I think it's appropriate for us to go ahead and vote, and I would suggest that we go ahead and do that. Do we have any other public comment?
Mr. DelMartini.
There were some, Steve DelMartini, there were some questions raised last meeting that I think haven't been answered, and I'm sort of curious. The questions of how long your entitlements last came up. What happens if you only get $3 million because we're in a down market in 4 years? And I think Michael could, I don't know how long it lasts. Once you get an approval, you know, how long that all goes on. If you're doing going to do the entitled infrastructure and have the lots just sitting there ready to sell, that's one thing. But if you're going to sell it as an approved project, then I think you should know that too.
With approval of a subdivision, that entitlement would last for 3 years, and then there's a possibility of 3 1-year extensions. So you have 5 years with the original approval, and that's not making then really any expenditures beyond what the entitlement process cost. There are things that you can do, though, to lock in, to record those lots. If you're creating those lots and you record that subdivision, then it's done deal. You've got those lots, and you can do what you will with them. So there's stages to the process. The first stage would essentially give you 5 years before you had to act to actually record the subdivision that gets approved on a tentative basis.
Mrs. Bowen, did you have some final comments?
Yeah, I just had a comment that I wanted to make. I know three of you have mentioned the 7-Eleven committee, and I don't know if you remember that the first time that they came and the information was presented to us, two of them said that one of the options presented to them.
It's a real privilege to work with all of you, and I find your arguments very impressive. You know, I really value what you've all said, and even though I may end up voting no, just as a, for all the reasons I mentioned, it doesn't mean that I don't have high hopes for a project like this working out in the best interest of everyone and the students and all, coming, blessing the project, you might say, even though I might vote no,
And those are kind words. Is there someone who would like to make a motion? Mr. Spadafore?
I would propose a motion that the board consider that we ask staff to move forward with the entitlement process to develop 14 R1 single family lots on this Johnson Street property and pursue all steps necessary to do that and advise the board as the process is ongoing.
And I'll second.
Okay. It's been moved by Mr. Spadafore and seconded by Mrs. Roger that we move forward on the entitlement process for the third option, which is 14 R1 single family lots. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
It carries 5-2. And I too want to just say this is really, I know, been a long process, and thanking the board for the really thoughtful discussion that we've had on it. Shall we?
I just wanted to thank everyone who came tonight to continue this discussion, including Mr. DelMartini and Mr. Codron from the city. I appreciate you bringing the expertise because it helps us make a better decision. Thanks very much. And staff, and of course, the help with OASIS. Thank you.
So shall we move on to the action consent agenda? And please, if there's anything that you'd like to have pulled, let me know. Item number 8, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Number 9, approval to teach a class outside of credential authorization. 10, acceptance of donations. 11, disposition of surplus property. 12, approval of furniture and equipment requests. Pull number.
Action items 8 through 17.
Well, and with, do you want to pull one out?
Which one do we pull?
Number 12.
Pardon me. I was, okay. Yes, okay. Except for 12.
Okay, so 8 through 11 and 13 through 17, and it's been seconded by Mr. Millar. Mrs. Botwin, number 13?
Yes, thank you. On page 12.2, it is 12.
I'm sorry, item 12.
On page 12.2, Russell, I meant to call you and I forgot. We've got spares up there, number 2 and 3, under equipment that totals about $4,000 almost. What does that mean, spare?
What we're doing is we're using the allocation the board gave us in order to keep current in our purchases of new equipment for technologies, and those are commonly pieces that break down with no notice, and we need to replace them quickly in order to keep the system running. It puts into inventory printers, inkjet, laserjet printers that can be taken from the district office shelves to the school site that needs them on a moment's notice to keep them running.
So if they break down, it's a real emergency?
Yeah.
Is that right?
It can be.
Okay, I move approval of item number 12, approval of furniture and equipment requests.
Let's move on to item number 19, advanced agenda. Does anybody have any advanced agenda items that they'd like to discuss at this point? Mr. Millar.
I'm wondering if maybe Friday packet or, I don't know. I am kind of intrigued by this whole idea of changing the experience limit and how that impacts us, both our salary scale and likelihood of being able to hire in teachers. We do have a pretty decent salary scale, and it has occurred to me that there's some job shopping going on among people to max out their STIRS retirements and things. So I mean, it's an interesting idea, and I think it goes back to what Dave was kind of talking about at the last board meeting, which is, are we really going to see the recruiting and retention problem that we expect?
That's a good idea. On a comment basis, this is an item that must be negotiated, and for us to talk about it, for us, it's in the contract, and it needs to be a negotiation item. I think we need to bring this forward
for the Friday packet. But I think that the consideration of hazing, and hazing, it might not just be for athletics, but for any participation. I know that bands were mentioned, other kinds of extracurricular activities. So I'd just like to have some more information about that, and if it's something that we might want to have added or consideration for added to the athletic contract, or possibly some of the other, like I'm saying, band, choirs, and things like that. And I think just what we've learned at CSBA is that hazing is not limited to guys on guys, that there is a lot of hazing that goes on in women's teams as well, and that it's absolutely inappropriate. We shouldn't condone it at all. If some other board member would have an interest in supporting me on that.
For the Friday packet?
For the Friday packet to start, and then perhaps maybe we would want to have some discussion on that later. Okay. All right. Anybody else for advanced agenda? I know we're going to have an interesting study session next time. Okay, seeing none, let's move on to the informational items. Anybody have anything they'd like to share with us? Mrs. Botwin.
Yeah, I was going to share about 20 minutes of my Scotland, England visits. I have slides. I have pictures. I went to a tasting at Glenfinnich. Whoa. Okay. The only other thing I wanted to mention was that I have a question here. We need, for 3 weeks, we need 12 badminton courts. And I was really pleased to see that 8 of them were taped, and that you expect that the center one would be rotated around and the kids will just, not use that. What kind of tape is there? Is there some kind of tape that you can put down for 3 weeks on the center court to give us the 12 badminton courts that we need for this 3-week unit for the basics for the kids?
The information that we had was that essentially once you put the tape down, there's potential damage to the floor, and that you'd want to leave it down for some period of time. But the other interest that the department had was that they wanted to keep the courts clean for volleyball and basketball. Now, we're not in basketball season, but we are in volleyball season.
Would you please just check around and see if there's some other kind of tape that would be able to go down and be pulled up and go down again, even if it were, you know, a day-by-day basis?
Well, we can look into that.
Yeah, to find out. And the students, when they come out, could lay them down?
But we certainly wouldn't recommend it.
Okay, let me just go this far. Would you bring us back some information about, is there tape that can be put down that
we
won't destroy?
That.
Yeah, that won't destroy the court.
Anyone else? Mrs. Dickinson.
I thought all of our discussion about due process was interesting in light of the fact that Friday night, right before midnight or whatever, the Senate passed something that pretty much does away with the writ of habeas corpus, and that arbitrary detention and abuse are now protected pretty much, and at the discretion of President Bush and those that he works with, which I think is a very significant development in the history of the United States. And for us who care so much about children and the country and the future that we're leaving to them and, you know, the things we've all held dear, I think it's a significant and extremely sad development. So I'm hoping that maybe overturned by Supreme Court or something, but it shouldn't go without notice because it's significant.
Okay, anybody else? Seeing none, would anybody like to move for adjournment? Mr. Peter moves for adjournment. Mr. Spadafore seconds it. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.